listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freib.
You've just gone very quiet, Richard, but hello.
Hello, Daniel. Quiet?
No, that's better.
And Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard. Hello, Daniel. Hello there in Berlin, Daniel.
Where are we, Lionel? Where are you, Lionel?
Well, we're in our home venue, the National Theatre on the South Bank in London, and you are in our away venue, Berlin.
Yeah, I'm in a vegan cafe housed in the basement of a squat.
Oh, my word.
What a beautiful picture you paint there, yeah. Daniel. Well, this is the three of us together again. We did one of these off-season rambles a couple of weeks ago. I think we're going to do something along similar lines
Hugely popular, I gather.
Apparently. We've got a little dispatch,
huge
though.
Danger of us jumping the shark.
we've got a package, however, from Ghent. We were at the Ghent 6 day last week, so we'll hear bit of nonsense from there. You and I were there, Lionel, and
a jiffy bag or a normal kind of package?
Oh,
topical 2 months ago.
news travels slowly there to Berlin. But first of all, before we go to Ghent, let's get your weekly news roundup, Lionel.
Okay, Rich. Okay, well, we'll start with the Ghent 6, which was won on the last lap in dramatic fashion by Bradley Wiggins and Mark Cavendish, ahead of Kenny De Ketelaer and Moreno de Pau. Totally unexpected victory for Wiggins and Cavendish there. Supposedly Bradley Wiggins' last race in the town of his birth. I don't know if anyone saw the post-race press conference. There were some clips of it on the sports website. Wiggins and Cavendish, they started off like the Chuckle Brothers and they ended up a bit more like Derek and Clive. It got a bit X-rated, didn't it?
I don't even know what that means.
Oh, Peter Cook and Dudley Moore improvised. They did their version of the cycling podcast off-season ramble back in about
several generations before my time, anyway.
Yeah, a long, long time ago, and it got very, very X-rated language. But if you know, students of a certain age, it was kind of cult listening. The other big news of the week is that the Criterium International has been cancelled by ASO. The two-day stage race at the end of March is no more. It started out as the Criterium National in 1932, and for many years it was only open to French riders, so it's only actually been the Criterium International since 1979. A popular two-day format with a flat stage, mountain stage and time trial. As Daniel pointed out on Twitter, kind of the ideal format for today's time-crunched, attention-short sports fans, but it is no more. It was a great race back in the day. Bernardino, Laurent Fignon, Sean Kelly, Stephen Roach and Miguel Indurain among the winners. It's moved around France a bit, and in recent years it's been in Corsica, but that's it, that's the end of it, and Thibaut Pinot will go down as the last winner of the Criterium International. The Cyclocross World Cup had a postponement at the weekend. The Coxeter round in Belgium was cancelled because of bad weather. The weather has to be really pretty bad to call off Cyclocross. It wasn't just the heavy rain, but the strong winds were a concern. Also a concern where all those Belgian fans would go and whether they'd managed to find enough beer in Coxeter to sustain them throughout Sunday afternoon. Just a final bit of transfer news. Jani Brakovic is on the move. He's going to ride for Bahrain Merida next season. It's a transfer which marks a return to the World Tour after a year with United Healthcare. Good stage race rider, handy addition to their roster.
Okay, thanks for that, Lionel. Fascinating as ever. Couple of gags in there, I noticed. Oh,
worked very hard on those, Rich.
I can see that. Well, listen, let's go straight to Ghent, because we were there last week. I think it was the second night that we were there. You were there a bit longer than me, but I was there just one night, and we recorded some stuff and we did a couple of interviews. So let's hear now from us in Ghent.
Where are we, Lionel?
We're in the track centre in Ghent at the Ghent 6 day, enjoying the atmosphere. We've had a couple of beers, haven't we?
Well, we're certainly soaking up the atmosphere. It's wild. It's my first time at the Ghent 6, amazingly. You've been here many times. How many times have you been here?
Not sure. I'm trying to count up. At least 7 or 8 over the years, yeah. First time was in 2001. I was here when Wiggins and Matt Gilmore won in 2003. And then in recent years, well, I think they've come to the last 3 editions, yeah.
Well, you've been showing me around the hot dogs and the various food stands, and this arena here, which is, can I call it iconic? It is iconic. It is iconic, isn't it? I've only been in here once before, the 2007 Tour de France. It was a press room. I really feel like I missed out until now, so it's a major tick off the list.
Yeah, I think it's something that every cycling fan within striking distance of Ghent should try once. If they don't like it, fine, but I would probably bet that if you come once, you'd want to come and make a weekend of it, because Ghent's a great town. It's, you know, it's a pretty grim time of year, isn't it? So to have an event that kind of occupies the evening, it feels pretty tropical in here, doesn't it, compared to being cold and grey outside.
And it's popular. It's sold out tonight. You were telling me earlier that it's sold out every single night for the first time in history.
That's right, yeah. Amazing, really. But the organisers were telling me that this is the first time that they've sold all six nights out with 2 weeks to go. They've had the weekend always sells out, but to sell out every night in advance has never happened before, not even in the days of Eddie Merckx and Patrick Surcoo in the 70s.
That's the thing we always talk about. We always tend to look back with rose-tinted glasses, don't we, our previous golden eras, and imagine that these events, and generally sporting events, are struggling to sell out or to you know, get bums on seats. And here's one that clearly could have sold many more tickets than they have. And I wonder why that is. I mean, they've obviously got the headline act of Mark Cavendish and Bradley Wiggins. Bradley Wiggins' farewell race before retirement, possibly. He was born in Ghent, so there's a connection there with him. You've got the local boy, Elio Kess, as well. And the crowd reaction to him, I think, has been more voluble than for Wiggins and Cavendish. So it seems to me that the crowd are drawn as much by the local lad as by the sort of headline names. I should mention Ilya Viviani as well, who's riding alongside Kess here.
Well, Ilho Kessa is the big favourite. He's won it six times. Patrick Surcoo has won it 11 times. That's the record. I think this joint's second most victories is seven. So if Kessa wins this week, he could go into second place. He's definitely a modern hero of six-day racing. I was talking to one of the organisers earlier this evening, and he was explaining that the long-term plan was for Wiggins to pair with Kessa here. And the thing he said to me was that if that was the case, then the only question would be how many laps would they win by over the course of the week, because he feels that Kessa and Wiggins are the two best endurance, combination of endurance and sprints for this particular event. But because Cavendish and Wiggins are the World Madison champions, they didn't feel that they could split up the rainbow jerseys, so that makes sense as well. But definitely having Wiggins in one team and Kessa in another will, I think, as the weekend goes on, make for much more compelling racing and a much closer contest.
Yeah, I think a lot of people wondering why Cavendish is riding. You know, he's a long, hard road season and track season, of course. So he's extending it well into the winter here, and we'll see what that does for his season next year. He does seem a little bit tired. I was asking a couple of younger riders, Mark Stewart and Ollie Wood, young British guys riding their first professional six-day race. Quite a baptism of fire for them. Speak to them earlier and asking them who impressed them most. And certainly Wiggins seems to be in great form, very strong. Cavendish maybe is feeling the effects a little bit of such a long season. Although, as they pointed out, they've had a long, hard season as well, and nobody's talking about them. It's interesting because these guys are, you know, track riders and road riders, and the difficulty now is where do you take a break? You know, Mark Stewart was saying that his main focus at the moment is on the World Track Championships. Then he'll begin his road season with a new team and POS, and he wants to ride big road events. And the question is, when will he actually get some time off to recover? For the modern day cyclist, has become a real challenge. As I said, I spoke to Mark Stewart at Hollywood earlier. Here they are.
It's different to any race we've ever ridden. It's kind of, I guess the timings are different. You race till like 1 a.m, you kind of, that's the first thing to get used to. It's relentless, especially this year with this field, as every race has been contested. It's just brutal.
What's it like racing on such a small track? I mean, how does that affect the intensity of the racing?
I think the main thing me and Ollie have noticed is your focus. But the chase is like 30 to 40 minutes, and you're changing every like 10 seconds because you can't switch off. You know, it's you constantly got to be such a small track where there's this many riders. There's always something going on, and it's that in itself's tiring. Let alone having to try and take laps and attack and chase. Just trying to focus on getting your changes right and getting your technique right and not getting in anybody's way.
Well, you're riding here against some of the biggest names in the sport. I mean, what's that feel like? I mean, you're going head to head with, you know, Wiggins, Cavendish, Viviani.
Oh, it's a bit daunting because you don't really want to crash into them or anything, you know. Especially those guys, especially someone like Cav's got a bit of a short temper, and we always end up getting in his way out with everybody.
Have you upset him yet?
Yeah, both of us last night, we got shouted at. But Cavs, he's like that when he's racing. I think he's that passionate about it. But afterwards, he comes and speaks to us, and I think a lot of the guys are keen to help us because they can tell, you know, like, you're racing against each other, but in the day, no one wants to crash, and we all want to stay safe. And I guess, you look at Wiggins, he rode his first six in 98, and I guess he was in our position, kind of just learning.
What's that, Ollie? I mean, there's another British team in the race, obviously. Have you had much contact with them? Have they spoken to you much?
No, we just sort of try and do our own thing and try and get through the best we can. And like I say, like Matt said, it's our first one, so try not get in anyone's way. I mean, we're here, we'll do our best in some events, but sometimes you just got to try and just get through it the best sort of shape you can, really.
How did you find last night, the first night? Was it pretty much as you expected, or was it more intense, faster, harder?
Well, I was pretty apprehensive going in. Never raced on a 166, and especially in Madison, it's a totally different ball game again. I was pretty shocked. It was using small gears, because obviously the track's so quick you can't push big gears, and if you did you'd probably just fly up the banking. So it's different from what we've been used to. Who's putting on small gears and just basically pedal as long as I can, as fast as I can.
Are you aware of the atmosphere here? Because it's a unique atmosphere in Ghent. You know, crowd's amazing every night. Is that something you're aware of as a rider?
Yeah, I mean, like Mark said, you've always got to be switched on, but you do get that 10 seconds sort of rest around the top every other lap, and you do not necessarily shouts for us, but people like Ilio and that, people crowd are just going mad for them.
How do you, as Mark said, you finished pretty late. How easy was it last night to wind down and to get to sleep?
Not bad. Yeah, not hard. I mean, we get some food back here, get changed, get back to the hotel, shower, and then just try and chill out as you would on a usual evening, except it's just about 5 hours later.
Do you sleep all right? I mean, were you able to sleep late?
Yeah, we slept no problem until 12:30, 1 o'clock, so it's all right. You still get your 8 hours in.
Yeah. What's next for you after this?
A lot of training in December, a bit of gym work, things like that, and then, like I say, there's a track World Cup in Cali and then LA, and probably hopefully do one of those.
Great, well, good luck with the rest of the week. Cheers. Cheers. That's how to do it, Lionel. Cavendish and Wiggins got caught. Viviani and Kess attacked. And they've got a lap. They got a lap in the blink of an eye.
They have indeed. And Kaiser there just did a little wheelie as he gained the lap there. Very flamboyant.
But it's timing, isn't it? But that timing is so hard to predict because, you know, Cavendish and Wiggins, when they were leading last night, so they're a threat, but so are Kais and Viviani, and it just seemed that they got it just right. You know, there was quite an effort went into just nullifying the attack by Wiggins and Cavendish, and they went and they got it.
They did, and all of these gained laps in the Madisons are what really make the difference in the overall standings, aren't they?
They like Kais and these parts, don't they?
Yeah, they certainly do. The big hometown favourite. His father owns a bar about 3 minutes walk from the velodrome here. Always very, very popular when he wins. I think he's won it 6 times, closing in on Patrick Surcoux's record.
My name is Roger de Martlar. What will be to difficult for English people to pronounce. It means martyr, by the way. M-A-R-T-Y-R. I was for 25 years here the press chief. But I'm still concerned with the organization. I'm so-called right hand of Patrick Sarku, and I've been in the organization since 1973.
So, can you remember the first time you watched the Ghent Six?
Oh yes, but then I was only a child. I was only 5 or 6 years old. I came with my father, who worked in a factory and who had to start working every day at 6 o'clock in the morning, so he couldn't stay because in those days they rode all night, and they rode 144 hours in a week, in 6 days. So my father and me, we came from the first minute until 1 o'clock, about 1 o'clock. There were special arrangements in the town in Ghent. Tramways waited for the last. They shouldn't now, because people sometimes they stay until 3 or 4 in the morning. Police has to get them out.
I learned this evening that this is the first time in history that all 6 nights of the event have sold out in advance.
Yes, I think it never happened anywhere else. In Ghent, certainly it has never happened. But I don't know if it ever... Well, there was one 6 day who pretended that it was sold out in advance. But you must be very careful with these statements, because it is not difficult to have an event sold out if you give away 1,000 tickets for free. We don't give 1,000 tickets for free. That's the big difference with before. And it may be, well, strange, but since many more people have to pay, the success has grown every year, which, with the maximum this year, of course, 2 weeks before the start, it was completely sold out.
And why do you think that was? Is that because Bradley Wiggins' final race? Or?
Well, certainly it has, certainly. Is it his final race, by the way?
We don't know yet.
No, we don't. But I heard that in London he said, well... That's typical Wiggo. He said, well, who knows? You know, I like the man. I like the man. And Wiggo is so good that it's no problem for him. If you make him ride on a 166-meter track or a 250, 55 or 300 meter, he has the consistency, but he also has the speed. He has maybe not so fast as Patrick Sarku. But there's only one Patrick Sarku, there's only Eddie Merckx, but there's only one Wiggo as well, you know. Cavendish is a great rider, let's not forget, because Milano Sanremo, world champion, 144 races on the road, 30... in Tour de France stages. But... my feeling on the track, he is not so quick as he is on the road.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
So that was a bit of atmosphere from the Ghent 6 and a few interviews in there as well. The young British riders Mark Stewart and Ollie Wood we heard from. Daniel, you were at the Ghent 6 last year, weren't you?
I was. Made a bit of a cameo. A couple of questions, chaps. I've got a couple of questions about the Ghent 6. Is it a bit like the 4 days of Dunkirk in that... a reverse of the 4 days of Dunkirk in that it only lasts 4 days? And if not, why not? Because 6 days of indoor cycling seems like rather a lot. Second question, I'm going to be very blunt about this. Is it fixed? Is it fixed? Because Mark Cavendish and Bradley Wiggins gaining a lap, three laps from the end. I know there are, you know, it's not just the Madison, and it's not the same every day. There are various other events, but essentially in the decider, gaining a lap. Three laps from the end seems almost incredible to me.
Right, well, I'll take the first question and Lionel can answer the second one.
Oh, thank you.
It's 6 days. Because, well, it's called a 6 day and it is, in fact, 6 days. And all the 6 days are 6 days long. So do you want to take the second question there, Lionel?
Great explanation about the 6 days. I'd like to add a bit more about that. They're 6 days long. Let's move on. Now, the issue.
Actually, in all seriousness, didn't a couple of them... A couple of them did get reduced to 3 or 4 days, or they have been in the last few years, and I think they were still calling themselves the 6 days. Grenoble, I think, was maybe one of the last
ones. But 6 day racing, it's enjoying a renaissance at the moment, isn't it? There's more, some of the old ones getting revived, this little series of London and Copenhagen
and
so on, and Amsterdam.
Coming up, yeah.
What about the Champions League?
And the Champions
That's
League,
isn't it?
Yeah. I mean,
that's coming up as well. We'll talk about that later.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that later.
On your question, Daniel, I mean, it's a thorny old topic. I mean, fixed is a really pejorative word, isn't it? I mean, it's.
Well, it certainly is.
Yeah. I mean, but put it this way, I wouldn't bet on it. I'm not even sure if you can bet on it. I don't know if you can.
You can bet on it being fixed, or
well, but I mean, talk to the organizer. And I spoke to Roger de Mertele and Guy Vermeer, and both part of the organization at the Ghent Six. And I did ask this question. Neither of them really said absolutely not, but they kind of skirted around it a bit and said that you have to be in top shape to win a race like the Ghent Six. I think there's just an element of mild scripting, isn't there? That's all I would say.
I think within 6 day racing, certainly some races are arranged, and that includes the sprinting races as well, which aren't held in every 6 day, but there was a sprinters competition at the London 6 day, for example. Certainly some of that stuff is arranged in advance, scripted. And I've been privy to that on occasions and been surprised at how unscripted it looks, so they're pretty good at putting on a good show. You definitely have to
less scripted than a Criterium, more scripted than Made in Chelsea.
That's a really good analogy.
Somewhere in between. yeah.
And I think within the 6 day races, there are some races. We spoke about this in connection with London, didn't we? The Derny racing, you know, is potentially extremely dangerous especially on a tight little track like Ghent. I wouldn't be surprised if there was some kind of order to that, or you know, some scripting of that. But you definitely do have to be in very good shape. I mean, the young British lads spoke about that, just how hard the racing was. There's no question, the racing is extremely, extremely hard.
The point of 6 day racing is it's the winter. It's fantastic entertainment. You see full on racing. You know, it really is elbow to elbow a lot of the time. Very exciting, incredibly hard. So take nothing away from that. My only question would be whether it's a great TV event. I don't think it comes across on the TV anything like the atmosphere and the spectacle that you enjoy when you're in the middle of the velodrome.
Which in a way is nice, isn't it? Which in a way is one of the charms of it. So much sport now, professional sport, is blighted by the fact that television offers a better spectacle, or at least an equal spectacle. And you know, I understand there were a lot of British fans there last week, and it's good that it's one of the sort of lieu sacré, the sacred places, the sort of hallowed events of professional cycling that you really have to, well, it should be on everyone's bucket list as a spectator.
Well, it was the first ever Ghent Six sold out in advance, first time in its history that happened. And we left the velodrome at 11:30, and there was a guy still trying to get in. Mm. You know, the session finished about 1 o'clock, but there was real interest. And you're absolutely right, Daniel. There's no place to experience it, to really soak it all up, like the velodrome itself. You know, and I would argue that the middle of the velodrome isn't the best place to watch it. You know, they're all sort of jammed in there, and that can be hard to follow. But from the stands, it's a fantastic place to watch. And you know, if you watch a Madison from start to finish and really pay attention, it's very rewarding, and you definitely can't follow it in the same way on television. It's impossible.
Shall we ramble on?
What about the old press conference, chaps?
Oh, dynamite,
wasn't
it?
There's a bit of beef about that, wasn't there?
That wasn't scripted, was it?
That was the least scripted thing of the whole week. That was, it's quite excruciating in places, quite funny. I mean, there was different, they're very... strong opinions about, you know, whether Cavendish and Wiggins behaved and conducted themselves in an appropriate way. I mean, they were just Cavendish and Wiggins, weren't they? You either like them or you don't.
Sort of Liam and Noel, aren't they? Is that a reference? You know, forget Derek and Clive, Daniel. Liam and Noel, that one. Surely you remember Oasis.
Yeah, it is. That reminds me, actually. I once described Mark Cavendish, paraphrasing or actually just plagiarising, ripping off a feature about, or something that was once written about Liam Gallagher, or something actually that Noel Gallagher once said about Liam Gallagher, him being like a man with a fork in a world of soup. And I once used that to describe Mark Cavendish.
A man with a fork in a world of soup. That's perfect.
And Bradley Wiggins is a man with chopsticks who wishes he had a fork.
I mean, I understand that this is the only time that Wiggins spoke to the press in Ghent.
He came and spoke to the press.
Yeah, he was pretty evasive at the opening press conference, and then he spoke at the end. And does that mean that the TUE saga has... I mean, it's certainly not been satisfactorily resolved as far as we're concerned. And obviously, the investigation is ongoing. But, you know, as far as he's concerned, I mean, he sort of wants to, you know, move on and not really address it anymore.
Exactly. I mean, his strategy from the start has been to ignore it. And that carried on in London and in Ghent. And that clearly is not the best way to deal with it. And so the question remains there, and journalists who attended the press conference on Sunday were told that he wouldn't answer any questions about that. I mean, talk about acting as if you have something to hide, you know? I mean, refusing to answer questions about something is never a sensible strategy. So it lingers on, and, you know, he dropped a few hints that he might race again. And
I suppose the fact that there were so many British fans that went there primarily to watch him, not to take anything away from Mark Cavendish, but they were there because they thought it was going to be Bradley Wiggins' last outing. That maybe demonstrates that, certainly as far as the hardcore of British fans are concerned, that it hasn't really dented his appeal.
In terms of his racing, though, I mean, what more is there he can do? He's riding for Team Wiggins, who are, you know, to all intents and purposes, a development squad. They don't get invites to a great number of top-level races. They will get more if Bradley Wiggins is part of the roster and if Wiggins is prepared to say, yes, I'll come and ride, they may well get invites to quite prestigious races. But I think the Abu Dhabi... Farrago probably didn't do too many favours. The organisers of that race, RCS, were certainly under the impression he would go there, and then he didn't go there whilst all of this TUE business had blown up. What will his appetite be to go and step back into the slightly less sheltered, less protected environment of road racing, where, you know, he may well get some less welcome questions directed at him. But the main thing is, what can he go and race?
Will
there be? Is there really going to be an appetite for a kind of a, you know, a bit like Frank Sinatra's comeback, a tour of 6 day venues next winter? I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure.
I'm not sure whether the general appetite and other people's appetite is going to be the deciding factor. I think that the key issue here is that he still has a huge appetite for it, and, you know, what I saw of the Ghent Six really underlined how much he just thrives in that atmosphere and how much he loves that atmosphere and loves that stage of 6 day racing. And I think that is what will ultimately keep him there, and that's what's making it hard for him to walk away, as well as, let's not kid ourselves, major financial incentives.
Shall we ramble on? Shall we move?
Well, I was going to ask Daniel about Cavendish, because he's, you know, carried on his season late into the year. Have you spoken to him at all recently, Daniel? I mean, does it mean he's going to start next year a little bit later? What's his thinking? Because I could understand Wiggins, you know, riding London and Ghent 6 days. I couldn't really understand it so much from Mark Cavendish's point of view.
No, not had too many dealings with him recently. Had a long conversation with him around about the time of the World Championships. You know, and at that point, I think foremost in his mind was what was going to happen with Dimension Data, whether they were going to retain their World Tour license, which they have. So he's obviously going to be delighted about that. I think, you know, I think he'd committed to do these 2 6 days a long time ago, and they're obviously helpful. I mean, they obviously keep him in decent shape for longer. It's no secret that he struggles with his weight in winter. He has done. I remember at the Giro d'Italia speaking to his sometime training partner, MotoGP rider, his great friend Cal Crutchlow, who referred to the Cavendish of last winter as like an elephant in quicksand when they rode together. So he does tend to struggle. I don't think it's any secret in the winter. So I think it helps from that point of view. And I think he'll be looking at more of the same next year, really. I mean, if he can repeat the season that he's had this year. I mean, it's been it's sort of lost among the sort of plaudits for Sagan and, you know, the British success in the Olympics and whatever. It has been slightly overlooked what an amazing season it was for Cavendish. You're laughing, Richard. What's going on?
No, I'm laughing at something Lionel's doing. Nothing at all. Your man Roger De Mertler made the point about Cavendish on the track. We were talking about Wiggins is just silky smooth on the track and looks so good and was in great form. He'd obviously worked hard for these 2 6 days that he did. And Cavendish, you know, you're always surprised because somebody who's got that incredible jump on the road, that incredible acceleration that he has, you just don't see it on the track. I think we've talked about this before. I don't ever feel that we see Cavendish at his best on the track for whatever reason.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
All right, thanks for that, guys. Just, you know, leaving that last sentence of mine hanging in there. There,
I think
about
we're gonna,
Mark Cavendish.
Yeah, we'll get that put on T-shirt.
What a couple of cowards! What a couple of cowards!
So what was the exact quote? Was it "We don't ever see Mark Cavendish at his best"? This is Madison World Champion Mark Cavendish, but Richard Moore says that we don't ever see him at his best.
Hey,
I was
joking. I mean,
I think what he said was The exact quote was "Mark Cavendish isn't very good at cycling." Richard Moore.
I was saying to Lionel last week actually at the Gent Six, he was of course silver medalist at the Olympic Games as well, behind Elia Viviani, who was riding the Gent Six all blinged up with his gold bike and his gold shoes and his gold helmet. And I did make the comment to Lionel. I said, I wonder if Mark sees that and he's inspired to maybe bling himself out in silver. But perhaps not. It would have been quite funny though, wouldn't it, if he'd turned up with the whole it all silver.
Yeah. Well, silver, you were trying shorts to get me to go and ask him a deadpan whether or not he thought considered a silver helmet and silver shoes and a silver bike.
Anyway, he's a really good cyclist, Mark Cavendish. Indeed, always indeed. Been a huge admirer of his work. Yep. And he's always very gracious off the bike as well.
And indeed, he's always been a huge admirer of yours, Richard.
Yeah, absolutely. We've always had a really good relationship. Anyway, we heard a little bit from Eurosport there. Thank you very much to Eurosport, who were showing the Gent 6. They showed the climax of the Gent 6 on Sunday. And the cycling coverage continues on Eurosport. They are showing the first ever Revolution Champions League meeting on Saturday, the 26th, that is, from 6:30 to 10 p.m. on Eurosport 2. So that should have been the second Revolution Champions League, but the Paris one was cancelled. This is in Manchester. Eurosport will also be showing round 2 in London the following weekend. And they're also showing the Amsterdam 6 day, starting on the 6th of December, all 6 days of that. So that's.
Do you think they've had to pay to use the name, use the trademark Champions League? So then the Champions League exists, for example, as our colleague and sometimes sometime guest on the podcast, Rob Hatch, has told us before. It exists in volleyball as well, the Champions League.
You would think that UEFA, being the sort of organisation they are, would have that well locked down, the usage of those words together. But I guess if the Volleyball Champions League predates the Football Champions League, who knows? It's an interesting question. But hopefully the organisers of the Revolution Champions League did check this out before they started using it on all of their marketing. Perhaps we should ask them. We'll ask them.
That's probably the most sensible thing. A few bits of business. Rapa Nui, our clothing manufacturer, they've been producing our T-shirts since we started T-shirts. They're doing a Black Friday offer this weekend, so you can get a Cycling Podcast T-shirt or hoodie at some ridiculous price. And we should say this in the run-up to Christmas is your last chance to buy one of our current range of T-shirts. We are doing something new in 2017. Full details will be announced very soon, but we'll be doing something new. You can probably guess what it is, given our sponsor.
Yeah, well, but we should say, you know, it's not the end of our relationship with Rapa Nui. I've been very happy with it. They've been fantastic to work with, produce great T-shirts, customer service, second to none.
Fantastic. Yeah. We've had, you know, a really good relationship with them. They've been really, really great people to work with. So big thank you to Rapa Nui. And they've produced lovely stuff and been nothing other than a joy to work with. We've got a couple of friends specials coming up, as mentioned earlier, 2020 Vision, which is our sort of look at the future of cycling and what it holds. That will be coming in the next week. And following that quite closely will be Bradley Wiggins Full Circle, as I mentioned earlier. And then very soon we'll also be launching our Friends Specials programme for 2017. So stay tuned for more on that. Couple of sad bits of news I want to mention. Couple of deaths of cyclists in Scotland. First one, Craig Dimmock, who is the uncle of a friend of mine, Alan. But Craig Dimmock, aged just 49, collapsed while riding his bike. He was a member of the Glasgow Green Cycle Club. Very keen cyclist and podcast listener. So it was very sad to hear of his death. And I know that more than 500 people attended his funeral in Bells Hill. So a very popular man in sort of business and cycling circles, Craig Dimmock. And also Jerry McDade, who's been a stalwart of the Scottish scene for many years, commissar, international commissar. He was also in charge of dope control at the Tour de France. In 1989, I think it was the year after the Pedro Delgado scandal, but he was a commissar at the very highest level for many years. He was president of Scottish Cycling. He was a protege of the great Arthur Campbell, who they used to... There was a great story about them. They both were fluent in French, being international commissars, and they used to speak to each other only in French on train journeys. And if one of them made a mistake, he had to buy lunch. You would wait a long time to hear a mistake, apparently, both being good Scotsmen. So Jerry McDade sadly passed away. He was a grand old age, Jerry McDade, but a very big figure in Scottish and international cycling for many years. What are we moving on to now, Lionel?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, Daniel wanted to talk about Thomas Dekker's book, I think. Have you been reading it, Daniel?
Yeah. I managed to come by a copy. Don't ask me how I got the copy. Don't ask me how I translated it.
How did you get a copy and how did you translate it?
Shady underhand operation that was, much like the subject matter of the book. No, I just wanted to talk about Thomas Dekker. I mean, you know, we've kind of been criticising, we've debated in the past about whether we should give... this kind of thing, any sort of platform, any kind of publicity. I mean, you know, this is an issue that I don't know whether, before I talk about the book itself, whether, you know, you guys want to just chip in on. You know, there's been a lot of talk, even in the wake of the US elections, about what it means, you know, with Facebook and the role they played in the result, what it means to give someone a platform, and is that kind of in itself, can it be irresponsible? I mean, my personal view on, you know, talking about someone like Thomas Dekker and talking about his story, I mean, he was obviously someone who got exposed for doping, is that we're historians, really, and our job is to document, you know, a period in professional cycling that we all know was pretty ugly, pretty unsavoury, and, you know, it's really up to sort of readers and the consumers and the audience to impose their kind of moral judgments on what they think about the whole thing.
Yeah, I think there's the reason for the distaste is because people perceive that the riders who write these kind of confessional books after they've stopped racing and are in many cases after they've been caught doping, is that they win twice in a way. They win first by, you know, their careers. They earn money as professional cyclists, and some people would very rightly argue that if they're doping, they're earning that money dishonestly. And then secondly, they're getting the chance to tell their story with their own, all of their own frames of reference. They're not really being, you know, there's no holding to account as such. They're getting to tell their story their way, which of course is everybody's right. I would argue that, you know, if there was no interest whatsoever, you know, nobody bought the book, then these things would dry up fairly quickly, I guess.
But these books do very well, don't they? Because there is an appetite for these stories, and they're interesting stories.
Yeah, they do very well, but maybe there is a slight misapprehension about how well they actually do. And, you know, people maybe imagine someone like Thomas Deck. I mean, he obviously shouldn't earn a single penny off having doped and having cheated. However, you know, we're not talking huge amounts of money, I would guess. And, you know, this is someone who, certainly if you read the book, it, as is the case with a lot of guys who have cheated and have based their life and based their career and based their self-esteem on a lie, I mean, he's not been in a particularly good place for a long time. And, you know, you're talking about, you know, he might have earned €50,000 advance or slightly more or slightly less for a book like this. So he's not getting hugely rich.
No, but you know, we can engage in sort of hand wringing and be very disapproving. The reality is we'll all read it, and lots of other people will read it because we're curious and we're interested. And it's funny, isn't it, how quickly you sort of wallow in a bit of nostalgia. You know, he's already talking about an era that has passed, and it is, as you say, we're historians in a way, and all of us, you know, fans, journalists, we're curious to know more about that era. And if he can tell us, if he can help paint a fuller picture of what went on, we want to know. We're curious, we're interested. There was a very good review of the book, I thought, on Cycling Tips website by Eric Rashk. A very honest review that kind of acknowledged that fact that we read this stuff because we're interested.
What are your first impressions, Daniel? What are your impressions of the book?
Well, it's a very good book. It's very well written by the ghostwriter, Tace Zonneveld. And, you know, there's been quite a lot of criticism, been quite a lot of people who have challenged details in the book. Michael Bogart is one former rider who's challenged the content of the book. Stephen de Jong's another.
Not sure I'll be able to look at Stephen de Jong in the same way again.
Well, Richard, this is the infamous Stephen de Jong story.
I know.
We obliquely referred to a Stephen de Jong story that we could never broadcast and we could never tell on the podcast and at live events. Well, sure, and I cannot remember who told me that story now. But
I can remember who told me, you.
Right, okay.
I can tell you that we can't tell the story in the podcast.
Can we not tell the story in the podcast? But it has been widely documented.
It has been widely documented, so if you want to know it, you can look it up.
Should we just suggest that people Google. Stephen de Jong, Thomas Decker.
Google awful stomach churning Stephen de Jong story, and I'm sure it will come up.
And I must stress that Stephen de Jong has denied that this ever happened.
Yeah.
Anyway, I mean, to get slightly more serious for a second, my experience with Thomas Decker, I remember I went to his house in Dirkshorn in the north of Holland just after the 2004 World Championships. He'd ridden very well there in the under-23 World Championships. He was going to ride for Rabobank the following year. And, you know, I went to his house, met his parents, and I remember that one of the abiding memories of that interview was walking into his living room and his computer, he had a desktop computer and it was on, and the screensaver was quite a sort of statuesque olive-skinned blonde lady who I recognised. And it was Yves Ambasso's sister, Elisa, who was quite well known on the cycling scene around that time. And I asked Thomas Decker how he knew Elisa, and this is all in the book as well. He'd met her at the World Championships, and he was supposed to come home the day after his races, but he'd ended up spending the evening with Elisa Basso instead, and he'd ended up getting a lift home to Holland from Jerry Knaterman, who's unfortunately died shortly after that. So he missed his flight in order to get to know Madame Basso slightly better. And there was another very funny story about the Tour of Lombardy the following week. Elisa Basso was nominally the girlfriend of Eddie Mazzolini, the former Italian rider at the time. And there was a story I remember hearing from an Italian rider that on the final bend, they were in about 7th or 8th position. Eddie Mazzolini came round the final bend in the Tour of Lombardy the week after the World Championships with Eric Decker. And he put Eric Decker into the barriers because he had heard, erroneously, that Eric Decker had been enjoying the company of his girlfriend, and it was in fact Thomas Decker.
This is extraordinary. You're listening. Yeah, you're listening to the TMZ cycling podcast.
Well, it is, but that's the interesting thing about the book. It's more than just, it's a life that's spiraling out of control, isn't it? On all fronts. Well, it's not just about doping. It's not just about taking drugs to be a better cyclist. It's about, you know, it's sex and strippers and it's all kinds of shenanigans.
Well, exactly. I mean, and this is a rider, and this was a character who was very ambitious and quite vain. I mean, I remember asking Thomas Dekker, because I think the year after that interview, I did a column with him in Pro Cycling, so I would speak to him every month. And I remember one month asking him the question, you know, asking him about doping. And he said quite obliquely, you know, I've already made up my mind about that, about what I'm going to do when the moment comes, when there's a choice to be made, but I'm not going to tell you what my decision is, which, you know, was a bit of a giveaway.
Wow.
But anyway, sure enough, Thomas Dekker, he a year or so after turning pro, or just in his second year as a pro, won Tirreno Adriatico. He was touted as possibly the next Dutch winner. Of course, Holland hasn't produced a winner of the Tour de France since 1918. Joep Zoetemelk. He was touted as a potential winner, and he won Tirreno Adriatico. He was going very, very well. Then he moved to Tuscany. He was coached by Luigi Cecchini, who at that time was quite notorious. And things, you know, just speaking to Dutch colleagues and Dutch journalists, things all seem to be pointing in one direction. And, you know, it seemed to be a kid with boundless ambition and who was very sort of sensitive to the trappings of fame and the trappings of being recognised in Holland. And, you know, just reading the book, it really shines a light on that whole process, and it shines a light on how vulnerable young sportsmen are, and young sportsmen of that disposition in particular, and particularly in professional cycling in that time. And, you know, there's quite a shocking scene where at the end of 2005, Thomas Dekker and his manager go for dinner with Thomas Dekker's parents, and they actually openly discuss whether Thomas should take the next step. And it's referred to in euphemistic terms, and what they're referring to is doping, and specifically working with Eufemiano Fuentes and undertaking a blood doping process. And the parents sort of give their tacit unspoken blessing, and you know, it wouldn't have mattered anyway. Thomas Dekker had made his mind up. But and from there, you know, just an awful lot of people facilitated, turned a blind eye, and really stood by and watched while his life spiraled out of control. And it spiraled out of control for 5 or 6 years thereafter.
And I think I'm right in saying he was caught exposed for doping after he'd cleaned up to a great degree. Is that right, Daniel? I mean, that just shows
that is correct.
Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, obviously he's I think he says in the book, you know, he'd seen the error of his ways and wanted to race clean. And of course, the last time we saw him really racing was at the start of last year, when he had a go at the hour record, which I've just called up on the internet. He quoted as calling it the worst hour of his life. But he got pretty close.
He's had some pretty good hours, according to his book.
But he's an interesting sort of test case in that he's sort of the first wave of millennial riders, but he really fell between two generations. Mm. He really fell between the old generation and the kind of generation that's come up in the sort of post-slipstream, post-HDC era, when it was kind of okay to talk openly about doping, and it was very much something that was on top of the agenda. And he turned pro in an old school team, and it was probably 3 or 4 years short of what would have been a very different experience.
It's very tempting though now, given the sort of second act of his career, which was with Garmin, the slipstream operation, you know, their record attempt, actually it was pretty shambolic, but he wasn't that far off Rowan Dennis's,
I think, 250 meters off. And when you watched him, I remember watching, because it was in Mexico, yeah, wasn't it? I mean, he really was a long way off the line going, yeah, around the corners. He had very little, if any, track craft.
But it was interesting to be reminded that he's a decent athlete, because, yeah, I think since he came back from his suspension, he was a very popular teammate, I think, within Garmin. You know, he was somebody who was always friendly, but he didn't show really anything, did he, of that ability that had led to him being so hotly tipped in the first part of his career. And so it's very tempting, I think, too tempting to conclude that, you know, his successes were down to the doping rather than the talent. I'm not sure that's a lazy assumption, but a natural one.
I think people, there's maybe a tendency to exaggerate in both directions.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen quotes since the book came out last week. I've seen various commentators talk about how, or I think even Thomas Dekker himself in interviews say that he recognised now how talented he actually was, and you know, it all been put in perspective, and he was one of, you know, that he might have been one of the greatest talents in recent memory. And then there are others who suggest that you know, actually he wasn't very good at all, and he was the product of chemical enhancement. I think the truth is probably somewhere in the middle.
But I wonder, there's a moment, an extract I've read of the book, where he comes to his senses a little bit on a Garmin training camp after another blowout. He's not, you know, doping for performance anymore, but you still feel that his life is out of control. And he sort of comes to his senses, and from then on, he seems to have a sense of perspective about himself and the sport, and, you know, and very little success. And you wonder if there's a connection there that, you know, we often wonder about this with elite athletes who seem, you know, on the edge. You know, that sort of personality is often the type of personality that succeeds at the highest level. There's a connection there, and that's another reason why we're interested in these stories, because they are people who do tend to be on the edge and lead very interesting lives.
The Cycling Podcast, in association with Rafa.
Thank you very much to our sponsor, Rafa. We're extremely grateful for their support. It enables us to do this podcast every week, doesn't it?
Yeah. Should we do some quick fire rambling?
Quick
to
fire.
Wrap up?
Let's do it. Well, we've got the Champions League. Do the song again, Daniel.
No, I can't. I'm in a problem.
Okay. It's a nice little blast there.
I suddenly became very quickly. Yeah. I very quickly became very self-conscious.
Got the Champions League, Revolution Champions League.
Daniel, you were crushed to hear of the demise of the Criterium International, I gather.
Well, I was, but on the other hand, I also think that it probably makes it makes perfectly good sense. I can well imagine that the Criterium International was difficult to turn into a profitable enterprise. You know, ASO run it, the Tour de France organisers run it, and, you know, we've heard for years and we know that they run a lot of their stage races at a loss.
Yeah. But that weekend on the calendar is ludicrous, isn't it? There's so much going on. It's the weekend of the Grand Prix Harald Becker on the Friday and Gent Wevelgem on the Sunday. There's, I think, usually the Tour Catalonia is on at that time.
Yeah.
Sometimes even the World Track Champs are on at that time. So there's huge competition for attention that particular weekend. And Criterium International, not a World Tour race, struggles to attract a super field, and being stuck in Corsica, not the most accessible for the teams either.
Well, and Lionel, we often talk these days about short stage races, particularly in terms of preparation and what purpose do they serve in terms of preparing riders for bigger objectives. And, you know, what for a stage racer, for someone who's going to do the Giro or the Tour, what purpose does it really serve? You know, and it's not a race that's ever really attracted classics riders. So, you know, you go there to ride a sprint stage, a time trial and a mountain stage. I mean, you may as well stay in Tenerife where you're, you know, 5 days into an altitude training camp, no?
Absolutely. I mean, it also takes place on the weekend that the clocks go forward. And I remember one year when the race was held in Charleville-Mézières, I basically forgot that the clocks were going forward and completely missed the start of the morning stage. So had a real wasted morning. I was just having a happy breakfast and not realising that I should have been 10 minutes down the road talking to bike riders.
I think that was probably the year, Lionel. That was the first year when it had moved to Charleville-Mézières. That was the first time I went to the Criterium International, 2001. And I remember we were talking about Thomas Dekker and his meltdown a minute ago. And that was really the kind of first stages of David Miller's sort of implosion. I went there with Jeremy Whittle and a couple of other colleagues from Pro Cycling. We arrived on the eve of the race, and David Miller was on his own. He was riding for Cofidis at the time, and he actually went riding with us, and we were a right ragtag bunch, you know. And one of the journalists who was with us, David Sharp, had never ridden a road bike before, and he fell off at the end at the bottom of the Campanile car park just as we set off. He fell off his bike, so that was how David Miller was preparing for the 2001 Critérium International. And he had quite big goals in that race, but then I remember him abandoning on the morning of the Sunday stage. And then, you know, it was quite clear at the time that he was pretty lost. And then sure enough, years later, when we read his autobiography, he talks about that race, and he talks about, you know, that being one of the kind of final sort of disappointments before he ultimately took the decision to start using EPO.
Must have been that bike ride with Freeboss that did it.
I can't keep up with Freeboss.
Massive disappointment there.
Need to have a word with the doctor.
Right, listen, should we wrap things up there? We've got a big week next week, haven't we? We're doing an event in London on Wednesday with Jonathan Vauters, who will feature, I think, in next week's podcast. Anyway, we'll try and grab him for some...
I'm going to be there.
You're coming, Daniel. You're going to be there.
First and return since Frexit.
Yep. And then the following night, Thursday night in Edinburgh, we're doing an event that's sold out now. Well, both of them are sold out, which is good. That's at the Signet Library, and that's with Francois Thomazot, our French friend, who will also be at the event in London.
It's also the Cycling Podcast Christmas dinner, and after we hang up with Daniel here, we've got to do the draw for the seating plan.
Got
all the names here.
Got them all cut out, yeah. Cycling Podcast Christmas dinner on Tuesday night. So we're in charge of the seating plan. Unlucky, Daniel. You've got no influence over that whatsoever. Before we finish, can I just mention a couple of things? I was at the Dave Rayner dinner a couple of weeks ago, my first ever Dave Rayner dinner. That was a lot of fun. A lot of good young riders there, including James Shaw, the young guy who's joining Lotto Soudal. He was there. Owain Doole was there, who's obviously off to Team Sky. John Dibben there as well, who's also joining Team Sky. Tao Geoghegan-Hart, another off to Team Sky. What an amazing, magnificent hairstyles those three have, Dibben, Doole, and Geoghegan-Hart. Anyway, that was good fun. And before that, our friend Orla Chinoui hosted the Braveheart dinner in Scotland. It raised £30,000 for young Scottish cyclists. Callum Skinner was there, the Olympic gold medalist. It also supported Katie Archibald. If you want to know more information about the Braveheart Fund, we've all been at that dinner before, haven't we? It's braveheartfund.co.uk. So go there and find out more about Braveheart Fund. They've got fundraising events as well as an annual dinner. Anything else, Daniel, from your end? Or are we just going to see you in London next week?
I think you'll see me in London. I'm coming over tomorrow.
Ah, okay, nice. Well, let's leave it there. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Good evening, chaps.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.